Hello, and welcome to another episode of Robbinsdale Revisited. Today, we're going to learn more about the 1920s. In the book Robbinsdale Then and Now, author Helen Blodgett says that Robbinsdale had an unprecedented building boom, and by 1930, its population had increased more than 200% to over 4,400 people. Robbinsdale also got a public water supply, so times were looking up and people thought it would last forever. Today, Pete Ritchie, president of the Robbinsdale Historical Society, will tell us more about the Roaring Twenties, including a local character named Captain Billy and his magazines called Whizbang and True Confessions. The boom in Robbinsdale included buildings like the Masonic Temple, Elim Church, and the historic Robbinsdale Library Building. Also, the Robbinsdale Airport opened as the fourth airport in the state of Minnesota. Let's learn more.
In Captain Billy's Whizbang, it was usually on the lighter side, but he would do some social commentary. And, you know, it also, he reminded everybody of the big change that Prohibition had made that I don't think a lot of people think about today. But before Prohibition, Robbinsdale was known for saloons. We had saloons because we had different liquor laws than Minneapolis. And there was a dry group here long before Prohibition that was always advocating that we need to get rid of these saloons. These saloons are nothing but trouble. They're flouting laws. They're flouting morality. But we forget is women didn't drink in these saloons. And there was a Robbinsdale saloon that the boiler blew up and sadly it killed, you know, four men and wounded some other people. The women were sitting outside on picnic tables because they generally didn't go into the saloon. They just weren't allowed when that happened, and some of them were injured but escaped. But you get to the 1920s, and this is really maybe the first time in American history. It's not like the Old West saloon where you might had, you know, you might have had some women there, but they were not there because they were drinking. but, you know, you get to the 1920s, and men and women are drinking together. And this is really what drives, you know, the flapper culture and the, you know, everything from the Charleston, you know, that men and women are not only dancing together, but they're getting rowdy together, and because they're drinking together. And that's what Captain Billy's Whizbang was all about, that get a flask, find that party, find that speakeasy, and you're going to get a girl. And of course, the readership was mostly male. He uses these pictures of women reading Captain Billy's Whizbang. I'm guessing that, you know, it just wasn't that popular among women. But, you know, the jokes are always about men eyeing women up. That's the you know, how are we going to hook up? How are we going to get drunk? How are we going to have a good time? And look at these old fuddy-duddies, and they obviously don't know what they're doing. So Captain Billy made a lot of money on that. Meanwhile, you know, he's putting Robbinsdale on the map because he's always mentioning what's going on in Robbinsdale and making fun of it and now hobnobbing with various Hollywood celebrities, because at this time, the movie industry is just getting going and he's right there and he's putting these people on the cover of his magazines. Joan Crawford appears on the cover of Captain Billy's Whizbang. That's every other issue has some sort of Hollywood celebrity. And then he starts, you know, doing Hollywood magazines too and just focusing on the stars. But he likes to ask them, you know, or at least compare, what would it be like if this person came to Robbinsdale? What would they think of Robbinsdale? Or what would the Robbinsdale farmer think of them, is always kind of his angle on that stuff. He does actually bring a celebrity or two into town. He brings Tom Mix to town, and we have lots of pictures of Tom Mix, you know, chatting with our local constable, whose name was Bloberger. And, you know, we had a couple motorcycle cops, and they were pulling people over that were racing down West Broadway. So, you know, we're a little bit of a speed trap. We do have a police force. We do have a justice of the peace. And we've got a mayor and the village council. But, you know, we're still under 5,000 people. So it's not a giant place, but it's a really active place. Meanwhile, the library club has more respectable institutions are still thriving. And we know that Captain Billy and Fawcett Publishing donated a few hundred dollars to get this building built. You know, all the businessmen in town donated money to get this building built. And then the Robbinsdale Library Club actually runs the library for probably just a year or two And then Hennepin County comes in and says, we can make this a branch library and you guys don't have to go it alone and you'll be part of this system. And they're like, great, yeah, let's have a Hennepin County library here and we'll just keep our club room in the basement. And they kept their club room in the basement. And even, you know, up in the 1960s, they're still recruiting members when this place is still a library and they're having their meetings. And, you know, they've joined various women's club organizations. And as we know, they have their own tea saucer and they have a little program for every one of their meetings. Their scrapbooks are filled with pictures of all of their members. And, you know, by the 1920s, these are people that were the wives and daughters of the earliest settlers. And, you know, even in the 1920s, you still have this, you know, list of maybe 100 names that just keep appearing over and over again. And it's fun to see their pictures when they're older and they're standing next to their husbands. And there's still newspaper headlines about, you know, the various early settlers passing away and how, you know, he was an early settler. He was a Civil War veteran. Adelaide Robbins, who is Andrew B. Robbins' wife, is still alive. And she's still living in the Robbins mansion through the 1920s. And Amy Robbins is here. Of course, she's got her own home. And Edith Robbins also has her own home, but there's still a lot of activity out at the Robbins Mansion. You know, T.B. Walker and people like that, you know, still come to town from time to time. We also know that Adelaide Robbins was a Civil War nurse, and in the late 1920s, there's this gathering of Civil War nurses, and she's prominent among them and is excited to be there in the newspapers. I'll talk about that too. So the tea house, you know, is one place where you have sort of a little cultural crossroads, but the library is really the spot where we've got a little more culture beyond the pulp magazines. And so the 1920s is just a roaring time, big time for business and big time for buildings. Not only, of course, we have the Mason Temple that's still there. We've got a couple car dealerships downtown, the meat market. We've got an expanding school and school district. We have Fawcett Publications and their three-story building. And then we get a few more churches. We get the Elam Church gets built by a guy named Henriksen, who also built a whole bunch of things in town. He built the Culp Mansion, and we'll talk about Donald Culp a little bit. So the Culp Mansion is down there where the Crystal Care Home is now, and this was just a giant building with huge dormers. And you could see Crystal Lake from it. It certainly wasn't right on Crystal Lake. You know, it's along West Broadway. We know from our members who, you know, grew up in the 30s and 40s that he was a collector and he had things like a totem pole in it that was imported from the Northwest in his backyard. You know, the house was also used as a sanitarium. Culp started out as the minister at the First Congregational Church. He eventually went and got a medical degree. And like so many of our famous physicians in Robbinsdale, he started selling various snake oils and sugar pills and saying that this would cure that, this, that, or everything. And you could come and recover from whatever was ailing you at his home. And he would tend you as your physician. And he did really well for himself. And his house, you know, when you look at the quality and the size of the homes in Robbinsdale, it was right up there with the Robbins Mansion. It was a huge place, and it, you know, stood until the 1960s. He further gained notoriety a few years later in the 1930s when, on vacation in Europe, he met a barbarian countess and married her and brought a little royalty to Robbinsdale. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get in the 1930s. But another mover and shaker along with our other businessmen. Of course, during the 1920s, Thomas Girling, who famously started a little bus company called the Jefferson Warner, it was Girling Warner originally. And this bus would, you know, pick up people in Robbinsdale and bring them down to the West Hotel. We have this sign hanging here in the Historical Society where you can get to the West Hotel for just 10 cents. And then his bus company went out to Anoka, and he thought he was going to be competing with the streetcar line, but he never really never really did. And he also would head west, but he was instrumental in getting roads built. Sometimes he would bankroll some of this with, I don't know where he was getting the money, but himself, things like the building of Rockford Road and the Jefferson Highway going out toward Osseo, he would provide funds. And then he gets elected to Congress. And of course, he's very concerned that women are going to get the right to vote. And he spends a fair amount of time trying to defeat that, but loses. But eloquent speeches about how we must preserve the femininity of women and how this would degrade their position in society by having to participate in something as soiled and horrible as politics. But he gets these roads built, unfortunately, and he's a big proponent of the automobile. I mean, we had a car or two in Robbinsdale, but it's not until the 1920s that people really start buying cars and driving around. Unfortunately, he dies in an auto accident. And the town, you know, he was the second village president or mayor, and he was just kind of a mover and shaker in town, and was quite a blow to the city to lose him. He was also a publisher of newspapers and just a big booster. So the fire department, you know, is getting a little more modern. They got a truck. They're still a volunteer bunch and still are summoned by a bell. At some point, we'll get, you know, more of a siren up there that will summon the volunteer firefighters. You know, we got a little more organized. We got a little more equipment. But even though the fire department is right downtown, the big fire in 1925 burns down pretty much half the block across the street before they can get there. And the fire started in, there was the Schuler hardware store. Schuler's had had various dry goods stores, a seed store, and it was, you know, a nice two-story brick building. They also lived upstairs, so they had to flee. They got out of there just in time, but their building burnt down and a few other things along that block also burnt down. The Kirkwoods, who had a home building business in the same building, also went down. They started running out of water to put the fire away, so they had to chop a hole in Crystal Lake and lay 3,000 feet of hose out to the site of the fire. Again, it was, you know, we just didn't have the infrastructure to pump water. So they were doing all sorts of things to try and get water to fires. The loss of that half a block or so was estimated at $150,000 at the time. It was probably the biggest fire during the 1920s. Just gets mentioned over and over. I think later on, Schuler and Schlosser, which was a partner, went into an appliance business, Maytag, et cetera, and they opened that a few blocks down by where Sacred Heart Church is. You know, we mentioned earlier the Lutherans, Elam Church gets going, and so now we've got the Congregationalists at one end of the street. You've got Sacred Heart and their school, which is by far the largest group, down at the other end of the street, and then you got Elam, which the Lutherans finally got a spot to go to, which I think probably was a nice thing for Christensen and some of our other Scandinavian folks. Just a quick note about Robbinsdale was not a particularly diverse place. Other than we had quite a few Catholics, most of them were probably Irish, at least from what I can tell. You did have one Jewish family named the Dovers, and they had come from England, and they started a little taxi cab business. And there is an African-American family, the Wright family, which is out there in Crystal. But beyond that, some Germans, Gus Urban, who owned the meat market and owned the block across the street that had the shoe store and various other little retail establishments, you know, is said to have spoken with a pretty thick German accent. And of course, we know that the blacksmith was Norwegian. So there was a few immigrants. The Robin Hotel gets built about this time, and there was a family called the Elwood family that owned it for many years, and we have some recollections from Mrs. Elwood, who talks about the various immigrants that came and stayed in their boarding house, Lithuanian, lots of Eastern Europeans. It's Really hard to tell if any of those folks settled here, but she was interested in all the different languages that would come through. So there were certainly some immigrants, and we know that in North Minneapolis, nearby, there was quite a few Jewish families and some African-American families at the time. So Robbinsdale is still having all this problem developing because they don't have the sewer system. They don't have the water system. You know, the electrical is okay. Most homes, there's no gas. Most homes are still heating with fuel oil that they're buying from SIPE in some cases. A movement sort of, and it's hard to say if it begins in Minneapolis or begins in Robbinsdale, but the idea is, you know, Robbinsdale was created so that it could avoid annexation, so that the area could avoid being annexed by Minneapolis. By the time you get in the 1920s, people were thinking, we want to be annexed by Minneapolis because look at what's developing on the other side of Victor Memorial Drive. There's all these big, beautiful homes being built. And the real estate people in particular are looking across that drive thinking, we can't make any money if we don't get, you know, the gas lines, the sewer, the water. So they start lobbying the city of Minneapolis and the village council in Robbinsdale. Let's just get annexed. And then all this goes away. We don't have to worry about putting in a water tower, or building our sidewalks, or improving our roads. Thomas Girling's not going to bankroll these roads anymore. Votes are taken at least three times, in the last one being almost in the 1930s. And every time the majority of people in Robbinsdale vote to be annexed to the city of Minneapolis, the Minneapolis Tribune is printing editorials that say things like, come on in, Robbinsdale. You're going to love it, you know. And at that time, Minneapolis had annexed a big portion of Richfield. And it's like, Richfield came in. You know, you should come in too. But you need a two-thirds majority. And even though the mayor, the village council, all the real estate people, there's still enough people in Robbinsdale that the initial founding of the village in 1893 is still in living memory. And these people just have no interest in becoming, no matter how many times they vote for it, they just can't get this crowd. So we don't get to become part of Minneapolis, but it's easy to see why it might have been a nice thing. Of course, we also have the Robbinsdale Airport in the 1920s. So it's not like we don't have an interesting piece of infrastructure. Yeah, I remember at the time, the idea of an airport was not so much that you're going to go get on a plane and go somewhere. The idea of an airport was, well, here's a grass strip and an empty field, and there's a bunch of guys that are tinkering in little garages, and they're building airplanes, and they go fly around, and that seems wild and dangerous, but exciting and fun, too. And they start capitalizing on that with various barnstorming demonstrations. And you also have a whole bunch of parachute demonstrations. And you know, this record gets set and broken so many different times, but various women are jumping out of airplanes and they're making the papers, and they're sometimes they call them aviatrixes, which I just love. They've learned to fly airplanes, but mostly they're parachuting, and that just becomes a huge deal. And you can get crowds of 1,000 people to come out and watch these women parachute out of these planes at the Robbinsdale Airport. Of course, they all make the newspaper when they do that. So some of the other tricks that are going on there is they would, you know, construct or find an old shanty or an old barn, and they would say, we're going to fly a plane through it. And there's a few pictures of the newspaper of these planes that are just crashing through these buildings. And, you know, sometimes they knock them over, sometimes they don't. But the Robbinsdale Airport becomes a big attraction. Unfortunately, it's not as useful as, say, a road or a streetcar system or anything else, because other than Captain Billy flying back and forth to his resort at Breezy Point from Robbinsdale, and he had his own pilot, and the guy was named Walter, but we know that in addition to flying Captain Billy back and forth, he liked to go visit people at the high school, and he met a young woman at the high school, and he flew her up to Breezy Point and married her. Parents were very upset, but, you know, many years later, they were still married and he was still flying. Got to brag about being Captain Billy's pilot. He also went down to Lake Pepin and hauled some water skiers behind his plane and broke some records for the fastest water skiing. He had a plane that could land on a lake. And so that was a big deal, too. He also got arrested for flying drunk and landing on Crystal Lake. So colorful characters. Robbinsdale had.
So we were talking about the Robbinsdale Airport, and of course Walter Bullock was Captain Billy's pilot, and would fly him back and forth to Breezy Point and cut off quite the commute time. Captain Billy often liked to talk about all the space-killing machines he owned, and so that was a motorcycle, a automobile, of course, a Bearcat is I think what he drove, and an airplane. Now Captain Billy wasn't a pilot. You know, people always assume he was a pilot, but he hired pilots, and one of his favorite was Walter Bullock, who I mentioned famously ran away with a high schooler here in Robbinsdale and married up at Breezy Point, and then flew back. But it was a glamorous life as a pilot, and we had all sorts of barnstorming demonstrations and parachute jumps out at the airport and big events like that. So Bullock got the airport started. Him and his buddies are all working in their garages, building airplanes, building engines, building motors, building propellers, working with balsa wood, the lightest materials they could find. And they would get these things up in the air, and they were reading magazines like Popular Mechanics. And that gave Captain Billy an idea, and he started his Modern Mechanics magazine in 1928, just like Captain Billy's Whiz Bang was probably based on a magazine called Jim Jam Gems. And just like, you know, True Confessions was very similar to that other magazine called True Stories. Modern Mechanics was very similar to Popular Mechanics. And in fact, their logo was so similar, they got sued. And then, in order to avoid looking too much like Popular Mechanics, they changed their name from Modern Mechanics to Modern Mechanics with an X. And that magazine was around for a really long time. Eventually, it just became Mechanics and is probably still with us in some iteration today. So Walter Bullock eventually meets a guy named Shank, and Shank starts this thing called Shank's Flying Service, and he later becomes a pilot for Northwest. His flying service was more like he would take you up and you could see what it was like to be in an airplane. He did a little bit of delivery, but he also started the Shank Flying School, and the airport did spawn a little bit of commercial business because across the street, this thing opens up called the Airport Cafe. It later becomes the Ellis Log Cabin. Of course, I always remember the Ellis Log Cabin because my principal in junior high was Demio Ellis, and this was his family business. There were some Greek immigrants, and they opened up this little cafe, and there was enough activity out at the airport with the barnstorming demonstrations and the Shank Flying School that they could operate that cafe. The building is still there. People go there now, and it's Steve-O's Bar. And so next time you're in Steve-O's and look around and wonder how old this place is, of course, that got started in the 1920s. Shank eventually goes on to become a pilot for Northwest, and a guy named Henry Holcomb buys the airport. Holcomb continues to provide flying lessons. When you get into World War II, the airport was going to close, but they decided to keep it open and start this sort of civil air defense patrol. And so these folks all had great uniforms, and I love the pictures of them because it's men and women, and for some reason the women's uniforms just don't fit. Their trousers seem to be too long. They're just too baggy, but they're standing there at attention in front of their airplanes. And the idea was they would get up there and patrol. And, you know, maybe if there was a Japanese plane, they could let everybody know. But they just started their civil air patrol. And of course, after World War II, the airport closed down. It was there was always a crash somewhere. Sometimes it was really tragic. Sometimes it was a drunken pilot landing in a lake. But the Robbinsdale Airport was probably one of the first airports in the state. I remember reading somewhere it was the fourth airport. It probably got started about 1920. It's a little bit up in the air there. And again, when you say airport, you know, we think of something, I don't know, like the Crystal Airport that's out there today, a small airport that has paved runways and, you know, a little tower. This was a grass strip. It looked a little bit more like if you'd ever been out to Maple Plain, there's a grass strip out there that they land little airplanes on. So a grass strip, couple outbuildings, and of course the Airport Cafe, which later became the Log Cabin. And then Captain Billy flying back and forth, and occasionally maybe bringing a movie star down from Breezy Point, like we mentioned Tom Mix. But we know that Clark Gable would get flown around by Captain Billy too, and chances are, if he came into Minneapolis, you know, then they would come up to Robbinsdale and get on Captain Billy's plane, and Walter Bullock would fly him up to Breezy Point. But it's funny to think whenever you mention the Robbinsdale Airport, people think of the Crystal Airport. But no, this was in Robbinsdale, about where Welcome Park is, at the very beginning of aviation history. Did Lindbergh ever stop here? I don't know. But how could he not? If there's only four airports in the state, he probably stopped here too. So in Robbinsdale in the 1920s, there was a name that echoed throughout the countryside, and that was Elizabeth Titus. For nearly four decades, this woman defied all the societal expectations and braved snowdrifts and sweltering summers and countless miles to deliver the lifeblood of rural America, which of course was the mail. And, you know, rain, snow, sleet, none of that stuff could stop her. And she, you know, brought out the Sears catalog to everybody and brought out the postcards that illustrate America at that time. And, you know, she didn't just stumble into the role of mail carrier. She had to beg and plead to get the job. But once she got it, again, she stayed in it for four decades. And, you know, she decided that, well, she liked delivering mail more than getting married. That's what she told the Minneapolis Tribune when they came out to talk to her. And so in 1920, she becomes not just a part-time, but the first full-time female rural mail carrier. And she held the job for 33 years, and she delivered parcels along what's Route 2 and Routes 1 and Route 11. And her daily journey was usually about 33 miles. And, you know, sometimes it was through woods and dirt roads and narrow lanes. And over the course of her career, she estimates that it was 325,000 miles, so enough to circle the globe more than a dozen times, just if we're looking for a strange statistic in there. And so she needed some mechanical skills too. You know, she's on these snow clogged roads, and so eventually she got a vehicle, but initially she was just walking these things. And so she was very resourceful, and it was kind of legendary. And although she told the Minneapolis Tribune that, you know, she'd rather do mail than matrimony. And this got a good chuckle and made for a good headline. Eventually, she gave up her route, and she was just working in the sorting room. And strangely enough, another mail carrier proposed to her, and they decided to retire and get married. So, you know, at the age in her 60s, she marries this other mail carrier, and there she is in the newspaper again, cutting her wedding cake. She postponed her marriage to deliver the mail to Robbinsdale, and the old pictures of her in her outfits are just wonderful. And she got to wear trousers, which just wasn't all that common when she was out delivering the mail. And maybe she just, again, modified the mail carrier's outfit. She looks like she's pretty content and has her satchel. And everybody was happy to see her when she came.
Thanks for listening. I'm Crystal Boyd. Robbinsdale Revisited is brought to you by the Robbinsdale Historical Society. Our little history museum is located at 4915 42nd Avenue North in the heart of Robbinsdale. We're open Fridays and Saturdays from 10 to 3. You can also visit us online at robbinsdale.org. You found this episode, so you know where to find the next one.
Bicycle into the city every Saturday to see our friends. Back home, sitting hand in hand, when the evening ends, when the evening ends, when the evening ends, in Robbinsdale, in Robbinsdale. Ooh.
Our theme music is provided by Gabe Barnett and The Rounders.